Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Scott Pelley's career in truth-telling began with a lie, fibbing his age at 15 years old to score a job at his local Texas newspaper. More than 45 years later, his career in journalism has led to an award-winning television news career at CBS as anchor for the network's nightly news and as 60 Minutes correspondent. He's covered the major news stories of the last few decades, from running toward Ground Zero on 9/11 to joining troops on the front lines to interviewing presidents. And as he looks back on his career now, Pelley is asking us, what does the news say about who we are as a nation, about the values we're supposed to share? This hour on Point, Scott Pelley's Truth Worth Telling. And you can join us. What from Scott Pelley's reporting has had an impact on you? What questions do you have about the news, about information, about truth? What questions do you have for this veteran journalist? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Dallas, Texas, is Scott Pelley. His new book is titled Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. Scott Pelley, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, great to be with you. A longtime listener, first-time guest.
Really? Well, it's we are correcting an oversight that it's been that we didn't have you on before now. But let me you're a newsman, so let me start with a little bit of news that you actually made fairly recently when you talked about the environment at CBS. So here you are on CNN's Reliable Sources just on Sunday when you criticized the environment at CBS Evening News during your tenure there as an anchor. So let's hear what you told CNN's Brian Stelter.
We've been through a dark period of the last several years of incompetent management and sort of a hostile work environment within the news division. I lost my job at the Evening News because I wouldn't stop complaining to management about the hostile work environment.
Scott, that was you on Sunday. And I just wanted to know if you'd like to elaborate a little bit about what you meant there. A hostile work environment?
Meghna, I'm surprised it made news because what I was discussing, it happened years ago, and the people who were there at the time in management are gone, in fact, long gone. And so the company took some really powerful actions to straighten these issues out. We have a new chairman of the corporation, Joe Iannello, who is a visionary CEO, and I have enormous confidence in. I've known him for years. And we have a new president of the news division. I'm a little bit embarrassed to say it is the first woman to run CBS News, but that's Susan Zirinsky. And I've known Z, as we call her, for 30 years. She's been at CBS more than 40 years. She's got CBS News DNA and is just one of the most principled people I've ever met in the news. And then finally, we have a new executive producer at 60 Minutes in Bill Owens, a tremendous man who I've known for more than 20 years. Bill and I have literally been in combat together overseas in many times. And the name Bill Owens probably doesn't mean much to your listeners because he's one of those behind-the-scenes guys. But if you had a chance to meet Bill, I'm sure you would think, this is the guy that I'd like to have running 60 Minutes. So I'm very optimistic about where we're headed. In fact, I'm more optimistic now than I have been in 30 years at CBS.
So, Scott, with all due respect, if I were sitting across the table from you in the Scott Pelley role, which I guess I am, I'd say that's an answer that's really skirting the question. Using the phrase hostile work environment now, especially given all that has happened at CBS. I mean, Charlie Rose was fired in November of 2017 for some very egregious sexual harassment. And now you're saying hostile work environment for men and women. I'm just wondering if you could tell us, what is it that you witnessed or experienced that led you to say this now?
Well, a great deal's been reported on this, Meghna, as you know. And you know, I don't want to add to that list of allegations that have been made today. I've probably said about everything I want to say on that particular subject.
Really? Why? Why now? Why say it now? It's been a year and a half.
Well, that's right. It has been a long time, almost 2 years. And I guess that's why, because so much has been done at CBS to make things better. And we are really in a vastly better place than we were before because of all of these executive changes and because of the new relationship those executives have forged with the staff. And I want to go forward from here. Yeah. I don't want to drag 2 years ago into the present rather than go forward.
I respect that. But one more thing, though, because what you're saying, what you said to CNN on Sunday was that you lost your job because you wouldn't stop complaining to management about the hostile work environment. It wasn't just any job. You were the anchor of the CBS Evening News at the time, the flagship news program, you know, of the network. And so to hear from you that a network anchor could lose his job or allegedly lose his job because he complained about a hostile work environment, that seems to kind of open up some new questions, even more questions about CBS management, doesn't it?
Well, not the current CBS management. I mean, these people who were involved in those days, like I said, are now long gone. And, I miss that job, Meghna. I really loved working with the people at the Evening News all around the world, a fantastic group of people. And on the day that I left them, it was important to me that they understood that I wasn't quitting on them. There was really not much said about why I was leaving the Evening News, but I told the staff the day that I left them that it wasn't my idea to leave. And that I didn't want them to think, after all I had asked them to do over a period of 6 years, I didn't want them to think that I was just quitting on them and heading back over to 60 Minutes.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. If you were doing this interview right now and you had a guest who had said something very interesting and provocative but didn't really want to go forward, how would you handle this moment? Because I'm thinking, what would Scott Pelley do right now to Scott Pelley?
I would go at it again and again, as you have, very skillfully. But I would also tell you that I really don't have anything more that I want to say about that today.
Okay, I'm going to give you a break from it because I have some compassion here as well, but we might come back to it. Just fair warning, because I'm sure that my spidey sense is telling me that there's more to this because you just kind of brought it up to CNN on Sunday. But we do have a book to talk about, so I'll come back to this in a second. Let me go back in time rather than the immediate present to the very beginning. You know, when I opened the show today talking about how when you were 15, you got your first news job in Texas that began with a little bit of a fib. So, you know, for someone who's had such an award-winning career over so many decades covering the most important news in the nation and around the world, tell us how you got started in this world.
You know, Meghna, I remember it like it was yesterday. My uncle, who was a photographer in Dallas, gave me a 35-millimeter camera, and I just fell in love with the thing. It was the most complex, most expensive thing I'd ever held in my hands. And I immediately fell completely for photography, and I wanted to be a National Geographic photographer. At the age of 15, heroes were Henri Cartier-Bresson and Ansel Adams and Gordon Parks, and I just studied and studied photography. So I wanted to get a job at the newspaper, the Lubbock, Texas Avalanche Journal newspaper, to one day maybe make it into the darkroom back in those days. So I got a job as a copy boy. Unfortunately, they only hired kids who were 16 and above. And as you've already noted, I had kind of a temporal problem. I was only 15. But I fibbed about that, and I got the copy boy job. And I worked in the wire room, did my high school homework at night while I was working the 3 to midnight shift. And after about a year of that, the executive editor of the paper came into the wire room. He was a big barrel-chested guy with Marine Corps bearing. His name was Dave Knapp. And he looked down at me as I was working on my homework, and he said, "Do you want to be a reporter?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I never gave it any thought." He said, "Well, do you or don't you?" And I said, "Well, sure, I guess." And he picked me up out of the wire room, sat me down in front of a typewriter, which I had no idea how to operate. And I've been a reporter ever since. I was 16 years old.
Ever since. Wow. And so looking back now, Could you imagine having done anything else?
I hope not, to tell you the truth. I often tell young people who are interested in journalism that journalism, and you know this, Meghna, is the world's greatest continuing education program.
Right.
And here I am, a young man growing up out in West Texas, a wonderful part of the country, but I wanted to see the world. I used to ride my bicycle to the library and check out every book I could about China, the Middle East, Africa, and I would just devour them. My big problem was they would only let me take 5 books at a time. And so I wanted to see the world, and journalism was the way to do that. When I walked into that newsroom at the Avalanche Journal with all the ringing phones and reporters with burned out cigarettes between their lips and all of that sort of thing, it was the most exciting place I'd ever been. All the news in the world came into my newsroom and was disseminated as far away as Muleshoe, Texas. And to me, that was just astounding.
Yeah. I mean, you've said to other folks that there would be no Scott Pelley had there not been, you know, Texas and Texas journalism at the time.
Absolutely. You know, my parents were greatest generation types. They were children in the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma. My father volunteered to be in the 8th Air Force during World War II, flew his 35 missions. My mother built airplanes while he was flying them over Germany. And, you know, you meet those people. Those are the people I grew up with. Those were their friends. Those were the people who were in Lubbock, farmers battling against the weather. And you learn a great deal about optimism and perseverance in a scenario like that.
Well, Scott, we have to take a quick break here. We are speaking this hour with Scott Pelley. He's CBS 60 Minutes correspondent. He anchored the evening news on CBS from 2011 to 2017. His new book is Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Scott Pelley. He is a correspondent for 60 Minutes on CBS. He anchored the CBS Evening News from 2011 to 2017, has received many awards over his many decades of journalism around the world, 3 DuPont Columbia Awards, 3 Peabody Awards, 37 National Emmy Awards. His new book is Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. And Scott, we've actually got some people already calling in. So let's go to Christian, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Christian, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Chakrabarty. Love your show. You're amazing. So I've got a question for Scott. You know, I love the anecdote of your parents as the greatest generation. And two quick questions. Why do you think there are not more unvarnished voices like yours when you stood up to power and asked very powerful people, why is there torturing of prisoners? And you just kept going for the truth, which I applaud, and I think 99.9% of all Americans do. You know, the Seb Gorkas of the world won't, but I applaud you for that. And my second question is, what would your parents say about the current president, who they might call him a mafia leech, you know, and or use a couple of other choice phrases, but what do you think your parents would call the current president?
Well, Christian, thank you for your call. And Scott, before you answer, since Christian mentioned specifically your questioning of national leaders around torture, we actually have a moment from that. So I want to play that for folks just to remind them. This is a 2007 interview that you did with then CIA Director George Tenet. You did this interview on 60 Minutes, and we hear how you pressed Tenet about interrogation of terrorism suspects.
You know, the image that's been portrayed is we sat around the campfire and said, oh boy, now we go get to torture people. Well, we don't torture people. Let me say that again to you. We don't torture people. Okay?
Come on,
so,
George.
We don't torture people.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
We don't torture people.
Waterboarding.
We do not. I don't talk about techniques, and we don't torture people. Now, listen to me.
So, Scott, tell us about that moment.
Well, George Tenet was never going to admit, has never admitted, what we now know, that the CIA did use torture, use techniques that were in violation of the U.S. anti-torture statute. And I wanted to press him as hard as I could on that. And if you go a little further into the interview, I ask him, well, then why were these techniques necessary at all? And that's when he said, because these are people that will never, ever, ever tell you a thing and will kill you or me 30 seconds after getting out of wherever they're being held. To me, that was the answer to the question. There's a lot of research in the book, Meghna. I went through the declassified CIA files. I found a number of letters and memos in which the CIA personnel were very concerned about being prosecuted for using these techniques. And in fact, they reached out to the George W. Bush Justice Department. And the letter is in the book. They essentially said to the Justice Department, look, we know these techniques are against the law. We want you to tell us on the front end that you will not prosecute any CIA people who use these techniques. And then I found a memo that came back from the Justice Department in which a CIA lawyer says, I just talked to the Attorney General and he's given us the all clear.
Well, you know, Christian wanted to know if, in Christian's views, our caller, he doesn't see as many journalists out there today who are willing to, in his phrase, speak truth to power to really press politicians that way. Do you agree with him?
Well, I think there are a lot of journalists who are pressing politicians. I think there are a lot of us who take this all very, very seriously, particularly in this day and time, Meghna, when the truth can be made to seem a lie and a lie can be made to seem the truth. I mean, that's where journalism comes in. We are living in this age in which never before in world history has more information been available to more people, and that's a great thing. But it's also true that never before in human history has more bad information been available to more people. That is where journalism comes in. The founders gave us, we the people, the power over the government. But the only way that we can wield that power is with reliable, independent information. And so I think a lot of reporters are burrowing into that. But I also worry that there are maybe too many people in our beloved industry, our beloved calling, who are in this to be famous, are in it to be celebrities and not to necessarily to be found credible. And I think that is the opening that allows a president to call us the enemy of the American people, and some small subsection of the American people believe that because too often we do, in fact, as Christian was saying, undermine our own credibility.
I mean, we can look at media very broadly, and especially if we fold in social media, as a kind of a disinformation factory right now. I wouldn't disagree with that assessment. But, I mean, that's looking at it through our current lens. Shouldn't we also, if we're going to be honest about it, look back even further and say perhaps we were set down this path the minute that that corporatization really became a driving force in media? And I'm saying this to you, someone who has worked at CBS, one of the three major networks, for years here. I mean, how much do we have to simply look at the business interests of media, of news, as part of the reason why we are where we are today?
Well, we measure success, don't we, in this media age by the number of viewers we have, the number of clicks we get, how far a person scrolls through an article before they give up on it online. And so those are useful measurements, I think. But I prefer to measure how many stories have you broken, how much justice have you been able to do, how many voiceless people have you been able to give a voice to? How much corruption have you ferreted out? I think one of the things about 60 Minutes is it is a beacon that tells you if you do this job right, there'll be an enormous audience for that. Hmm. I mean, next season is our 52nd season. People come to NPR to listen to independent, reliable information. And I think there's a hunger for that today, Meghna, that we haven't seen in a very long time. We now live in this age where, you know, think of it this way. What is the fastest way to destroy a democracy? Is it terrorism? Is it war? Is it another Great Depression? I don't think so. I think the fastest way to destroy a democracy is to poison the information. The Russians, the North Koreans, they get this. Some cynical actors, some cynical politicians, they get this. And that's where journalism comes in. Madison wrote that freedom of the press is the right that guarantees all the others. The author of the Bill of Rights said that as long as we can read what we want to read, say what we want to say, write what we want to write, then all of our rights would be protected. So the stakes are just that high.
It doesn't seem, though, that we have leadership in Washington that espouses to those beliefs.
Well, you know, we were very frank in the first year of the Trump administration when I was managing editor of the Evening News. We were very frank about where the president was telling the truth and where he was not and how we knew those things. And not long after that, the president called CBS News the enemy of the American people. Now, I saw the president with several other anchors at a luncheon at the White House not long after that. And I said, you know, Mr. President, attack the media, of course. That's fine. Fair enough. But this kind of incendiary language is going to create violence in this country. I'm concerned that some poor deranged individual is going to walk into a newspaper or a television or a radio station and shoot the receptionist because she's the enemy of the American people. And the president thought about it for a second. He looked up at the ceiling. He looked back down at me and he said, and this is a direct quote, "I don't worry about that," end quote. Now, many months later, I get a call from the FBI, and your viewers are going to remember the man who mailed a dozen bombs or so to people that he perceived were enemies of the president. Mm-hmm. Well, the FBI called me to tell me that this bomber had a file on me and my family in his computer, and they had our home address. This is exactly what I'm worried about right now in our country, is that this rhetoric is getting out of control on the left and on the right.
Yeah.
We don't want to see political violence in this country again. We saw that in the 60s. And it seems to me that we need to turn down the temperature on that. Go ahead and have a healthy debate. That's the only way democracies work. But we need to turn down the temperature on who's the enemy of the American people.
You know, Scott, in a democracy, things happen at the most fundamental level because the people allow it, whether it's through the ballot box or through not pushing back against their political leaders, through not, you know, using their own voices, what have you. The people allow it, right? There's that famous phrase of, you know, in democracy, the people get what they want and they may get it good and hard. And the reason why I bring this up is because, if I may, one of my fundamental concerns right now is I agree with you that disinformation is a deadly and terrible thing in any liberal, with a small L, liberal society. But I think there's a critical mass of people who simply don't care. And I'll give you an example that we had a caller on this show last week who we were talking about whether or not congressional Democrats should proceed with their investigations of the Trump administration. And this caller called in And he's self-identified as a Democrat. I mean, party doesn't really matter, but he happened to self-identify as a Democrat. And he said, I just don't want to know it. I don't want to hear it. I don't care. I just want to move on and, you know, talk about infrastructure or what have you. When you hear that, Scott, do you feel as concerned as I do?
I absolutely feel as concerned as you do. And, Meghna, this is one of the things that I think threatens the future of our country and whether we're going to have another American century in front of us. It seems to me that at least on the far left and the far right, we're beginning to pull away from one another and ensconce ourselves in what I call digital citadels of confirming information. There are now cynical media sources that only peddle confirming information. They tell you that what you already believe is right. And that's a very warm feeling, of course. You're not challenged to think. But democracies don't work that way. The American experiment is an experiment that involves all the people of the world. We all live here. We've come from every corner of the earth to live in the United States. We're unique that way. The only way you can have a peaceful government that provides for the people is through debate and coming together. You know, there are no American flags that have just the stars of the conservative states and just the stars of the liberal states. There's only one kind of American flag. It has 50 stars, and all the stars are gathered there on that blue field, which is, after all, called the Union. Mm-hmm. I fear that we are tugging at the thread that binds us together when we stop listening to one another. That's where journalism comes in. We facilitate programs like On Point, facilitate the national conversation. But to your point, what I will call fake news, there is a certain demand for it now. And it's those Americans that we need to reach out to and say that we don't want to move left or right. We want to move forward, and we have to have a big national conversation around that.
So many more questions to ask you about that, Scott. But let me make a little room for our callers again. Michael is calling from Syracuse, New York. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. I'm a social studies teacher, high school, Syracuse, New York, and always caught Scott on the evening news when I could. Not as easy to do with a 3 and 6-year-old running around. But a comment and a question. I was always, you know, appreciated at the end of a story or at the end of a segment. You could just kind of see Scott's reaction to it. Maybe it was an emotional story or it was an uplifting story. And, you know, maybe like some tears in his eyes or a smile. And I guess the question is, how hard was it not to react to stories like that?
Oh, boy. I was famous among the staff for it. My daughter says that I cry at sunsets, and of course, it's true. The staff, very often Steve Hartman's work. Steve did feature stories for us. He is one of the very best writers in all of television, in my book. And his stories pack an emotional wallop. And they used to take bets in the control room at the CBS Evening News. Scott's going to cry over this one. And I would see it for the first time with the audience. I looked at all of our stories before they went on the air, except Steve's. I always left that one to be genuine. And I had that genuine reaction every time I saw Steve's pieces in particular. And so I don't think it's a terrible thing to show a little bit of your humanity when you're the anchor of the evening news or a correspondent on 60 Minutes. I think that lets people know where your heart is.
Huh. And so, you know, if I can just link back to something that we were talking about a second ago, I mean, heart actually has a lot to do with it. You organize your book, Scott, in an interesting way around values, right? Gallantry, gratitude, invincibility, and then the stories that you've covered that highlight those values. Why did you choose to organize the book that way?
You know, Meghna, I sat down. I wanted to write a memoir, but I didn't want to write a memoir about me. I didn't think anybody would care about that. But it occurred to me that I had met the most fascinating people in the world, some of them famous, some of them you've never heard of, but people who discovered the meaning of their lives in some of the most difficult moments of our history. So, for example, the first chapter is called Gallantry, and it's about the members of the Fire Department of the City of New York on 9/11. I was at the World Trade Center when the buildings came down, and I watched those firefighters stream into those buildings against just the chance that they might be able to save someone. And so I've written about those people who exemplify the greatest values that we all hold dear.
Yeah, well, when we come back, we'll talk more about your personal experience of 9/11. Scott Pelley is joining us this hour. He is a correspondent for 60 Minutes on CBS. He anchored the evening news on CBS from 2011 to 2017. His new book is Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Time. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Scott Pelley. He is a correspondent for 60 Minutes on CBS, of course. He anchored the evening news there from 2011 to 2017, and he's out with a new book called Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. And Scott, before the break, we were talking about 9/11 and what you witnessed there, the firefighters going up the buildings of the Twin Towers, up the stairwells there. I want to play a moment from your reporting on that day. This is just hours after the attacks on the World Trade Center in 2001. And you were on the air from a payphone near Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan, describing what you were seeing before your very eyes, describing it to then-anchor Dan Rather. But here you are on 9/11.
The site of the World Trade Center tower that I can see here is a hulk about 15 stories tall, shattered, broken at the top, with huge columns of smoke rising in front of the sun. Sorry, it's very smoky down here. And the smoke has turned bright orange as it rises over Manhattan because of the back from the sun.
That's Scott Pelley on September 11th, 2001. Scott, you tell this story in the book, but how is it that you were reporting from a payphone?
Well, the cell phone system went down, of course, Meghna, and I had no way to report back to the office. And so after I had run away from the collapsing World Trade Center towers and then made my way back to what would become known as Ground Zero, I discovered a payphone there. I didn't have a quarter. I'd stopped carrying quarters with cell phones, and so I picked up the receiver, and sure enough, there was dial tone. The phone company had a plan to switch all payphones to coin-free mode in cases of emergency. So I called into the newsroom, and then CBS was on the air for 96 hours straight. No commercials, no breaks, no nothing, all day, all night for 96 hours. I think it may have been our finest hour.
How did that day, being there, right there in Lower Manhattan, surrounded by billowing dust and chaos and carnage, how did that compare to your other experiences around the world in various war zones, for example?
You know, when I got to the World Trade Center and saw the tower standing, I had a sense of joy believe it or not, because I thought, well, the buildings are still standing. People are going to get out. This is great. And as soon as I thought that, I saw the television tower mast on World Trade Center number one start to tick back and forth like a metronome. And I thought it must be the heat torturing the light, an optical illusion. But the building came racing down at that point. I don't remember how I got there, but the next thing that happened was, the next thing I remember is I'm on my knees on the street and I'm calling out to God out loud. And I said, Lord, take them all with no pain. I don't remember getting up. The next thing I remember is running as fast as I could with a big crowd of people with the sound of steel crashing behind me onto the street. After a certain period of time, I don't know how far I ran, it occurred to me that the conflagration behind me was beginning to calm down, so I turned around and started walking back into Ground Zero to do my job, to start reporting. You know, independent, reliable information is critical to a democracy every day, but never more critical than on that day. And so we went on the air and just reported all day, but I had seen the deaths of almost 3,000 people, but 343 firefighters of the FDNY went up into that tower and were killed in those 90 or so minutes after they arrived. And I wanted to write about them. One of the most important things to me is that the FDNY feels like that this is somewhat of an adequate tribute to the gallantry and sacrifice that I witnessed that day. And so this first chapter was the chapter that I worked on the most and rewrote over and over and over again as I was making my way through the rest of the book. You know, it occurred to me that the firefighters didn't know who attacked us. They didn't know what 9/11 was about. But it didn't matter because they knew what they were about. Years or decades before, they had sworn an oath to protect the people of the city of New York. They had decided then what they would do on that day, and they did it selflessly. And it is the greatest loss of life of any emergency service in history, and I don't want that to ever be very far from our minds.
So, Scott, in the arc of from 9/11 to in the mini arc from 9/11 to that interview that you did with George Tenet, for example, you have been witness, you have reported on the very best of us, meaning this nation, and then conversely, perhaps the worst of this nation. And this is a central question that you're wrestling with in the book. What have you learned about us, about who we are in your 40-plus years of reporting on this country?
You know, Meghna, this returns me to something that you had mentioned earlier. And your question, if I don't mischaracterize it, was essentially, are we becoming too lazy as Americans to support a democracy? Because, I mean, for example, we're asked to vote in federal elections once every 2 years, and half of us can't find the time. Well, it occurred to me that in the stories of these people in the book, I find that that is not the case, that we are not too lazy for democracy. The chapters, as you noted, are named after virtues such as selflessness, like the Air Force theater hospital nurse that I met in a combat zone in Iraq who gave her own blood during a surgery to save the life of a young Marine. I have met so many great Americans over these many decades, and I am always filled with optimism. You know, Walt Whitman said this about poets, but I think it's true for me. He said, he who sees the furthest has the most faith. So when people are wringing their hands and gnashing their teeth about where we are right now, I try to tell people that the Constitution is a durable document, that we're going to be okay, and that you just have to take the long view to have faith in America.
Well, let's go back to our phones. Dan is calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes, and I agree 100% about the selflessness in the U.S., but I also believe that society is teaching selfishness, not selflessness anymore. But, you know, as far as the news and everything, I also feel that we've gotten either too far left or too far right, and we need to come back to the middle in order for everything to build off of the foundation that we should have.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you could basically go to one channel or another and know who's going to be supporting who as far as politically.
Yeah. Well, Dan, thank you for your call. Scott, go ahead.
And that is not journalism, what Dan just described. Journalism is a quest to open minds, not close them. And I agree with Dan completely. There are cynical media organizations that are pursuing a business model. This isn't even ideological. They're just pursuing a business model to carve out a small part of the left and the right and provide them with confirming information. Democracies don't work that way. Democracies were invented so that diverse people could get together and move forward.
Hmm. Well, you know, Scott, we've been talking about the stories that you've covered, and then underneath that, there's this fundamental discussion of the nature of what truth means in America today. And I just want to play a cut from February of 2017 and how you opened the CBS Evening News on that night, because in the anchor chair there at CBS, you were not afraid to take a stand on issues that you felt weren't being presented accurately to the public. So here's Scott Pelley on February 2017.
It has been a busy day for presidential statements divorced from reality. Mr. Trump said this morning that any polls that show disapproval of his immigration ban are fake. He singled out a federal judge for ridicule after the judge suspended his ban, and Mr. Trump said that the ruling now means that anyone can enter the country. The president's claims, whether imaginary or fabricated, are now worrying even his backers, particularly after he insisted that millions of people voted illegally, giving Hillary Clinton her popular vote victory. There's not one state election official, Democrat or Republican, who supports that claim.
That's Scott Pelley opening the CBS Evening News in February of 2017. Now, Scott, the reason why I wanted to play that is it's easy for us in this conversation to talk about being champions of truth, but I'm certain that many people, when they heard that broadcast or others that you did in the anchor chair, for example, that into their ears they didn't hear truth, but they heard bias. You must have heard from viewers when you presented the opening of the news in this way.
You know, I write about this in the book, Meghna. I believe that the bias is in the viewing, not in the reporting. I think people see what they want to see and hear what they want to hear. I have examples in the book in which I received letters after saying something on the evening news or on 60 Minutes, and I have letters on both sides of the question, as if these people had seen different stories. And so I think a great deal of the bias is if we are honest with ourselves, is in the viewing and not in the reporting. But it was shortly after that broadcast that the president called CBS News the enemy of the American people.
Mm. Well, Scott, I haven't forgotten that I promised to ask you more about your statements on CBS having a hostile work environment. I have not forgotten that. But lucky for you, there's actual news that we need to talk about as well. I want to lean on your expertise on this, because today Special Counsel Robert Mueller actually stood at a podium at the Justice Department and spoke for the first time in a couple of years. He announced that he said he's speaking today because the Special Counsel's report is complete. It was made largely public, and he was announcing that he was closing the Special Counsel's office and returning to private life, retiring from the Department of Justice. He said that the department's written work, or the counsel's office's written work, should speak for itself. And then here's a little bit of what he said. This is Robert Mueller about his views on whether or not the Department of Justice should charge a sitting president.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional.
That's Robert Mueller a little earlier today. Scott Pelley, for those people that were hoping that Mueller would say more, give us insight into his view of the Department of Justice's handling of the special counsel's report, he did not. He just made a pretty brief statement and then walked off the stage. But you've spoken to Mueller. How significant was it that he stood up in front of the Justice Department today and spoke at least a little bit?
Well, to tell you the truth, Meghna, I'm very surprised, having heard what he had to say, I'm very surprised that he did it at all. There really wasn't anything surprising or, in my view, reportable about that. The most surprising thing to Americans is probably going to be the sound of his voice. They have probably never heard his voice before. A number of years ago, I was doing a documentary about what happened in and around the White House on the day of 9/11. And the president and the White House were cooperating with this. And Mueller, at that time, was director of the FBI. And so I asked for an interview, and they said no. So I went to the White House, and I said, hey, I need some help with Mueller here. And so finally the FBI said yes, and I sat down with Mueller at FBI headquarters. And the first words out of his mouth were, who the hell do you know at the White House? I may have done the only interview with Robert Mueller, and that was the year after 9/11. He is a tough, by-the-book guy who has really no use for the media. He speaks in legal briefs that are filed before federal judges. And I was very surprised that he came out today. He really didn't have much to say.
Right. I mean, the Justice Department, the White House reportedly was informed last night that this would happen. Mueller spoke at the Justice Department itself. It does beg the question why he did this. Now, as to the sound of his voice, to me, I mean, it's hard to know how much to read into how someone sounds at a podium, especially when they don't have any use for the media. It sounded a little wavery. I mean, is that the sound of the Robert Mueller that you interviewed?
No, not really. I was a little surprised to hear it. I didn't see it. I heard it sitting in this radio studio waiting to go on the air with you on Point. And so I hesitate to characterize it because I didn't actually see it with my own eyes. But it did sound kind of hesitant. It sounded like he was under pressure. And Bob Mueller is somebody who can handle pressure. I was a little surprised to hear that quaver in his voice.
Hmm. Well, Scott, we've just got a minute left to go here. And there are, of course, so many stories about your career thus far that we could talk about. But in the last couple of seconds we have, I'm just wondering, what is it that you want to do next? What's the interview that you want to bag or the story that you still want to chase down?
You know, there are a lot of stories that I want to chase down, places I want to go. I think this administration on many levels needs to continue to be investigated, just as the founders expected us to do. This is American democracy working exactly the way it was designed. So we have our 52nd year at 60 Minutes coming up, and I hope to be with the broadcast many years to come.
Well, Scott Pelley is a correspondent for 60 Minutes on CBS. He anchored the evening news there from 2011 to 2017, has won just about every award possible in broadcast news. His new book is Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. There's a link to an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Scott Pelley, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Meghna, thank you so much for having me. I'm very grateful to be on Point.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.